He laughed. It was more than Sam could stand. He stumbled away from the fire pit, stepping awkwardly over and around the man sleeping and squatting and dying upon the hard-packed earthen floor. The smoke and screams and moans were making him feel faint. Bending his head, he pushed through the hanging deer-hide flaps that served Craster for a door and stepped out into the afternoon. The day was cloudy, but still bright enough to blind him after the gloom of the hall. Some patches of snow weighed down the limbs of surrounding trees and blanketed the gold and russet hills, but fewer than there had been. The storm had passed on, and the days at Craster's Keep had been, well, not warm, perhaps, but not so bitter cold. Sam could hear the soft drip, drip, drip of water melting off the icicles that bearded the edge of the thick sod roof. He took a deep, shuddering breath and looked around. To the west, Olo Laphand and Tim Stone were moving among the horse lines, feeding and watering the remaining garrons. Downwind, other brothers were skinning and butchering the animals deemed too weak to go on. Spearmen and archers walked sentry behind the earthen dikes that were Craster's only defence against whatever hid in the woods beyond, while a dozen fire pits sent up thick fingers of blue-grey smoke. Sam could hear the distant echoes of axes at work in the forest, where a work detail was harvesting enough wood to keep the blazes burning all through the night. Nights were the bad time, when it got dark and cold. There had been no attacks while they had been at Craster's, neither whites nor others. Nor would there be, Craster said.
A godly man's got no cause to fear such. I said as much to that manse rider once when he come sniffing round. He never listened, no more than you crows with your swords and your bloody fires. That won't help you none when the white cold comes. Only the gods will help you then. You'd best get right with the gods.
Gilly had spoken of the white cold as well, and she'd told them what sort of offerings Craster made to his gods. Sam had wanted to kill him when he heard. There are no laws beyond the wall, he reminded himself, and Craster's a friend to the watch. A ragged shout went up from behind the daub and wattle hall. Sam went to take a look. The ground beneath his feet was a slush of melting snow and soft mud that Dolorous Ed insisted was made of Craster's shit. It was thicker than shit, though. It sucked at Sam's boots so hard he felt one pull loose. Back of a vegetable garden, an empty sheepfold, a dozen black brothers were loosing arrows at a butt they'd built of hay and straw. The slender blonde steward they called Sweet Donald had laid a shaft just off the bull's-eye at 50 yards. "Best that, old man," he said.
"Aye, I will."
Alma, stooped and grey-bearded and loose of skin and limb, stepped to the mark and pulled an arrow from the quiver at his waist. In his youth he had been an outlaw, a member of the infamous Kingswood Brotherhood. He claimed he'd once put an arrow through the hand of the white bull of the King's Guard to steal a kiss from the lips of a Dornish princess. He had stolen her jewels, too, and a chest of golden dragons, but it was the kiss he liked to boast of in his cups. He notched and drew, all smooth as summer silk, then let fly. His shaft struck the butt an inch inside of Donald Hill's.
"Will that do, lad?"
he asked, stepping back.
"Well enough," said the younger man grudgingly. "The crosswind helped you. It blew more strongly when I loosed."
"You ought to have allowed for that, then. You have a good eye and a steady hand, but you'll need a deal more to best a man of the Kingswood. Fletcher Dick it was who showed me how to bend the bow, and no finer archer ever lived. Have I told you about old Dick now?"
"Only 300 times.
Every man at Castle Black had heard Ulmer's tales of the great outlaw band of yore, of Simon Toyne and the Smiling Knight, Oswin Longneck the Thrice Hanged, Wender the White Fawn, Fletcher Dick,
Big Belly Ben, and all the rest. Searching for escape, Sweet Donal looked about and spied Sam standing in the muck.
"Slayer," he called, "come show us how you slew the other."
He held out the tall yew longbow. Sam turned red.
"It wasn't an arrow, it was a dagger, dragon glass."
He knew what would happen if he took the bow. He would miss the butt and send the arrow sailing over the dike into the trees. Then he'd hear the laughter.
"No matter," said Alan of Rosby, another fine bowman. "We're all keen to see the Slayer shoot, aren't we, lads?"
He could not face them, the mocking smiles, the mean little jests, the contempt in their eyes. Sam turned to go back the way he'd come, but his right foot sank deep in the muck, and when he tried to pull it out, his boot came off. He had to kneel to wrench it free, laughter ringing in his ears. Despite all his socks, the snow melt had soaked through to his toes by the time he made his escape.
"Useless," he thought miserably. "My father saw me through. I have no right to be alive when so many brave men are dead."
Gren was tending the fire pit south of the compound gate, stripped to the waist as he split logs. His face was red with exertion, the sweat steaming off his skin. But he grinned as Sam came chuffing up.
"The others get your boots, Slayer."
"Him too."
"It was the mud. Please don't call me that." "Why not?"
Gren sounded honestly puzzled.
"It's a good name, and you came by it fairly."
Pip always teased Gren about being thick as a castle wall, so Sam explained patiently.
"It's just a different way of calling me a coward," he said, standing on his left leg and wriggling back into his muddy boot.
"They're mocking me, the same way they mock Bedwick, by calling him giant."
"He's not a giant, though," said Gren. "And Paul was never small. Well, maybe when he was a baby at the breast, but not after. You did slay the other, though, so it's not the same. I was scared." "No more than me. It's only Pip who says I'm too dumb to be frightened. I get as frightened as anyone."
Gren bent to scoop up a split log and toss it into the fire.
"I used to be scared of John. Whenever I had to fight him, he was so quick, and he fought like he meant to kill me."
The green damp wood sat in the flames, smoking before it took fire.
"I never said, though. Sometimes I think everyone is just pretending to be brave, and none of us really are. Maybe pretending is how you get brave, I don't know. Let them call you Slayer. Who cares?"
"You never liked Sir Alistair calling you Oryx."
"He was saying I was big and stupid."
Gren scratched his beard.
"If Pip wanted to call me Oryx, though, he could, or you, or John. And Oryx is a fierce, strong beast, so that's not so bad. And I am big, and getting bigger. Wouldn't you rather be Sam the Slayer than Sir Piggy?"
"Why can't I just be Samwell Tarly?"
He sat down heavily on a wet log that Gren had yet to split.
"It was the dragon glass that slew it. Not me, the dragon glass."
He had told them. He had told them all. Some of them didn't believe him, he knew. Dirk had shown Sam his dirk and said,
"I've got iron. What do I want with glass?"
Black Manar and the three Garths made it plain that they doubted his whole story. And Rowley of Sisterton came right out and said,
"More like you stabbed some rustling bushes, and it turned out to be Small Paul taking a shit. So you came up with a lie."
But Dywin listened, and Dolores Ed, and they made Sam and Gren tell the Lord Commander. Mormont frowned all through the tale and asked pointed questions, but he was too cautious a man to shun any possible advantage. He asked Sam for all the dragon glass in his pack, though that was little enough. Whenever Sam thought of the cash John had found buried beneath the fist, it made him want to cry. There had been dagger blades and spear heads and 200 or 300 arrowheads at least.
John had made daggers for himself, Sam, and Lord Commander Mormont, and he'd given Sam a spearhead, an old broken horn, and some arrowheads. Gren had taken a handful of arrowheads as well, but that was all. So now all they had was Mormont's dagger and the one Sam had given Gren, plus 19 arrows and a tall hardwood spear with a black dragonglass head. The sentries passed the spear along from watch to watch, while Mormont had divided the arrows among his best bowmen, Muttering Bill, Garth Greyfeather, Ronald Harclay, Sweet Donald Hill, and Alan of Rosby had 3 apiece, and Alma had 4. But even if they made every shaft tell, they'd soon be down to fire arrows like all the rest. They had loosed hundreds of fire arrows on the fist, yet still the whites kept coming.
It will not be enough, Sam thought.
Craster's sloping palisades of mud and melting snow would hardly slow the whites, who climbed the much steeper slopes of the fist to swarm over the ring wall. And instead of 300 brothers drawn up in disciplined ranks to meet them, the whites would find 41 ragged survivors, 9 too badly hurt to fight. 44 had come straggling into Craster's out of the storm, out of the 60-odd who cut their way free of the fist, but 3 of those had died of their wounds, and Bannon would soon make 4.
"Do you think the whites are gone?" Sam asked Gren. "Why don't they come finish us?" "They only come when it's cold." "Yes," said Sam. "But is it the cold that brings the whites, or the whites that bring the cold?" "Who cares?"
Gren's axe sent wood chips flying.
"They come together. That's what matters. Hey, now that we know that dragonglass kills them, maybe they won't come at all. Maybe they're frightened of us now."
Sam wished he could believe that. But it seemed to him that when you were dead, fear had no more meaning than pain or love or duty. He wrapped his hands around his legs, sweating under the layers of wool and leather and fur. The dragonglass dagger had melted the pale thing in the woods, true, but Gren was talking like it would do the same to the whites.
"We don't know that," he thought. "We don't know anything, really. I wish John was here."
He liked Gren, but he couldn't talk to him the same way.
"John wouldn't call me Slayer, I know, and I could talk to him about Gilly's baby."
John had ridden off with Corrin Halfhand, though, and they'd had no word of him since.
"He had a dragonglass dagger, too. But did he think to use it? Is he lying dead and frozen in some ravine? Or worse, is he dead and walking?"
He could not understand why the guards would want to take Jon Snow and Bannon and leave him, craven and clumsy as he was. He should have died on the fist, where he'd pissed himself 3 times and lost his sword besides. And he would have died in the woods if Small Paul had not come along to carry him.
"I wish it was all a dream. Then I could wake up."
How fine that would be, to wake back on the fist of the first men, with all his brothers still around him, even John and Ghost. Or even better, to wake in Castle Black behind the wall and go to the common room for a bowl of 3-finger hubs, thick cream of wheat, with a big spoon of butter melting in the middle and a dollop of honey besides. Just the thought of it made his empty stomach rumble.
"Snow!"
Sam glanced up at the sound. Lord Commander Mormont's raven was circling the fire, beating the air with wide black wings.
"Snow!"
the bird called.
"Snow! Snow!"
Wherever the raven went, Mormont soon followed. The Lord Commander emerged from beneath the trees, mounted on his garron, between old Dywin and the fox-faced ranger, Ronald Harclay, who'd been raised to Thorin Smallwood's place. The spearman at the gate shouted a challenge, and the old bear returned a gruff,
"Who in 7 hills do you think goes there? Did the others take your eyes?"
He rode between the gateposts,
one being a ram's skull and the other the skull of a bear, then reined up, raised a fist, and whistled. The raven came flapping down at his call. "My lord," Sam heard Ronald Harclay say, "we've only 22 mounts, and I doubt half will reach the wall."
"I know that," Mormont grumbled. "We must go all the same. Craster made that plain."
He glanced to the west, where a bank of dark clouds hid the sun.
"The guards gave us a respite, but for how long?"
Mormont swung down from the saddle, jolting his raven back into the air. He saw Sam then and bellowed,
"Tarly!"
"Me?" Sam got awkwardly to his feet.
"Me!"
The raven landed on the old man's head.
"Me!
Is your name Tarly? Do you have a brother hereabouts?" "Yes, you! Close your mouth and come with me."
"With you?"
The words tumbled out in a squeak. Lord Commander Mormont gave him a withering look.
"You are a man of the Night's Watch. Try not to soil your small clothes every time I look at you. Come," I said.
His boots made squishing sounds in the mud, and Sam had to hurry to keep up.
"I've been thinking about this dragon glass of yours."
"It's not mine," Sam said.
"Jon Snow's dragon glass, then. If dragon glass daggers are what we need, why do we only have two of them? Every man on the wall should be armed with one the day he says his words."
"We never knew."
"We never knew? But we must have known once. The Night's Watch has forgotten its true purpose, Tarly. You don't build a wall 700 feet high to keep savages in skins from stealing women. The wall was made to guard the realms of men, and not against other men, which is all the wildlings are, when you come right down to it. Too many years, Tarly, too many hundreds and thousands of years. We lost sight of the true enemy, and now he's here, and we don't know how to fight him. Is dragon glass made by dragons, as the small folk like to say?"
"The maesters think not," Sam stammered. "The maesters say it comes from the fires of the earth. They call it obsidian."
Mormont snorted.
"They can call it lemon pie, for all I care. If it kills as you claim, I want more of it."
Sam stumbled.
"John found more on the fist, hundreds of arrowheads, spearheads as well."
"So you said. Small good it does us there. To reach the fist again, we need to be armed with the weapons we won't have until we reach the bloody fist. And there are still the wildlings to deal with. We need to find dragon glass someplace else."
Sam had almost forgotten about the wildlings. So much had happened since.
"The children of the forest use dragon glass blades," he said. "They'd know where to find obsidian."
"The children of the forest are all dead," said Mormont. "The first men killed half of them with bronze blades, and the Andals finished the job with iron. Why a glass dagger should—"
The old bear broke off as Craster emerged from between the deerhide flaps of his door. The wildling smiled, revealing a mouth of brown, rotten teeth.
"Oi of a son."
"Son,"
cawed Mormont's raven.
"Son, son, son."
The Lord Commander's face was stiff.
"I'm glad for you."
"Are you now? Me? I'd be glad when you and yours are gone. Past time, I'm thinking.
As soon as our wounded are strong enough—"
"They're strong as they like to get, old crow, and both of us know it. Them that's dying, you know them too, cut their bloody throats and be done with it, or leave them if you don't have the stomach, and I'll sort them out myself."
Lord Commander Mormont bristled.
"Thorin Smallwood claimed you were a friend to the watch."
"Aye," said Craster. "I gave you all I could spare. But winter's coming on, and now the girls took me with another squalling mouth to feed."
"We could take him,"
someone squeaked. Craster's head turned. His eyes narrowed. He spat on Sam's foot.
"What did you say, Slayer?"
Sam opened and closed his mouth.
I only meant, if you didn't want him, his mouth to feed, with winter coming on, we could take him and...
My son? My blood? You think I give him to you crows?
I only thought...
You have no sons. You expose them, Gilly said as much. You leave them in the woods. That's why you only have wives here and daughters who grow up to be wives.
Be quiet, Sam, said Lord Commander Mormont. You've said enough. Too much. Inside.
My lord.
Inside.
Red-faced, Sam pushed through the deer hides back into the gloom of the hall. Mormont followed.
How great a fool are you?
The old man said within, his voice choked and angry.
Even if Craster gave us a child, he'd be dead before we reached the wall. We need a newborn babe to care for, near as much as we need more snow. Do you have milk to feed him in those big tits of yours? Or did you mean to take the mother, too?
She wants to come, Sam said. She begged me.
Mormont raised a hand.
I will hear no more of this, Tarly. You've been told, and told, to stay well away from Craster's wives.
She's his daughter, Sam said feebly.
Go see to Banner now, before you make me wroth.
Yes, my lord.
Sam hurried off, quivering. But when he reached the fire, it was only to find Giant pulling a fur cloak up over Bannon's head.
He said he was cold, the small man said. I hope he's gone someplace warm, I do. His wound, said Sam.
Bugger his wound, Dirk prodded the corpse with his foot. His foot was hurt. I knew a man back in my village lost a foot. He'd lived to 49.
The cold, said Sam. He was never warm.
He was never fed, said Dirk. Not proper. That bastard Craster starved him dead.
Sam looked around anxiously, but Craster had not returned to the hall. If he had, things might have grown ugly. The wildling hated bastards. Though the ranger said he was base-born himself, fathered on a wildling woman by some long-dead crow.
Craster's got his own to feed, said Giant. All these women, he's given us what he can.
Don't you bloody believe it. The day we leave, he'll tap a keg of mead and sit down to feast on ham and honey and laugh at us, out starving in the snow. He's a bloody wildling, is all he is. There's none of them friends of the watch.
He kicked at Bannon's corpse.
Ask him, if you don't believe me.
They burned the ranger's corpse at sunset in the fire that Gren had been feeding earlier that day. Tim Stone and Garth of Oldtown carried out the naked corpse and swung him twice between them before heaving him into the flames. The surviving brothers divided up his clothes, his weapons, his armor, and everything else he owned. At Castle Black, the Night's Watch buried its dead with all due ceremony. They were not at Castle Black, though.
And bones do not come back as whites.
His name was Bannon,
Lord Commander Mormont said, as the flames took him.
He was a brave man, a good ranger. He came to us from... Where did he come from?
Down White Harbor way,
someone called out. Mormont nodded.
He came to us from White Harbor and never failed in his duty. He kept his vows as best he could, rode far, fought fiercely. We shall never see his like again.
And now his watch is ended,
the Black Brother said in solemn chant.
And now his watch is ended, Mormont echoed.
Ended,
cried his raven.
Ended.
Sam was red-eyed and sick from the smoke. When he looked at the fire, he thought he saw Bannon sitting up, his hands coiling into fists, as if to fight off the flames that were consuming him. But it was only for an instant, before the swirling smoke hid all. The worst thing was the smell, though. If it had been a foul, unpleasant smell, he might have stood it. But his burning brother smelt so much like roast pork that Sam's mouth began to water, and that was so horrible that as soon as the bird squawked,
"End it!"
He ran behind the hall to throw up in the ditch. He was there on his knees in the mud when Dolorous Ed came up.
"Digging for worms, eh, Sam? Or are you just sick?"
"Sick," said Sam weakly, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
"The smell. Cor, never knew Bannon could smell so good, eh?"
Ed's tone was as morose as ever.
"I had half a mind to carve a slice off him, eh? If we'd had some apple sauce, I might have done it. Pork's always best with apple sauce, I find."
Ed undid his laces and pulled out his cock.
"Cor, you best not die, Sam, or I fear I might succumb, eh? There's bound to be more crackling on you than Bannon ever had, eh? And I never could resist a bit of crackling."
He sighed as his piss arced out, yellow and steaming.
"We ride at first light, did you hear? Sun or snow, the old bear tells me, eh?"
"Sun or snow?" Sam glanced up anxiously at the sky.
"Snow," he squeaked. "We ride, all of us?" "Well, no, some will need to walk, eh?"
He shook himself.
"Darwin now, he says we need to learn to ride dead horses like the others do. He claims it would save on feed, eh? How much could a dead horse eat?"
Ed laced himself back up.
"Can't say I fancy the notion, eh? Once they figure a way to work a dead horse, we'll be next. Likely I'll be the first too. Ed, they'll say, dying's no excuse for lying down no more. So get on up and take the spear. You've got the watch tonight, eh?" "Well, I shouldn't be so gloomy, eh? Might be I'll die before they work it out, eh?"
"Might be we'll all die, and sooner than we'd like," Sam thought as he climbed awkwardly to his feet. When Craster learned that his unwanted guests would be departing on the morrow, the wildling became almost amiable, or as close to amiable as Craster ever got.
"Past time," he said. "You don't belong here. I told you that. All the same, I'll see you off proper with a feast. Well, a feed. My wife can roast them horses you slaughtered, and I'll find some beer and bread."
He smiled his brown smile.
"Nothing better than beer and horse meat. If you can't ride 'em, eat 'em. That's what I say."
His wives and daughters dragged out the benches and the long log tables and cooked and served as well. Except for Gilly, Sam could hardly tell the women apart. Some were old and some were young, and some were only girls, but a lot of them were Craster's daughters as well as his wives, and they all looked sort of alike. As they went about their work, they spoke in soft voices to each other, but never to the men in black. Craster owned but one chair. He sat in it, clad in a sleeveless sheepskin jerkin. His thick arms were covered with white hair, and about one wrist was a twisted ring of gold. Lord Commander Mormont took the place at the top of the bench to his right, while the brothers crowded in knee to knee. A dozen remained outside to guard the gate and tend the fires. Sam found a place between Gren and Orphan Us, his stomach rumbling. The charred horse meat dripped with grease as Craster's wives turned the spits above the fire pit, and the smell of it set his mouth to watering again, but that reminded him of Bannon. Hungry as he was, Sam knew he would retch if he so much as tried a bite. How could they eat the poor, faithful Garrons who had carried them so far? When Craster's wives brought onions, he seized one eagerly. One side was black with rot, but he cut that part off with his dagger and ate the good half raw. There was bread as well, but only two loaves. When Ulma asked for more, the woman only shook her head. That was when the trouble started.
"Two loaves!"
Clubfoot Carl complained from down the bench.
"How stupid are you women? We need more bread than this."
Lord Commander Mormont gave him a hard look.
"Take what you're given and be thankful. Would you sooner be out in the storm eating snow?"
"We'll be there soon enough."
Clubfoot Carl did not flinch from the old bear's wrath.
I'd sooner eat what Craster's hiding, my lord.
Craster narrowed his eyes.
I gave you crows enough. I got me women to feed.
Dirk speared a chunk of horse meat.
Aye, so you admit you've got a secret larder. How else to make it through a winter? I'm a godly man, Craster started.
You're a niggardly man, said Carl, and a liar. Hams, Garth of Oldtown said in a reverent voice.
There were pigs last time we come. I bet he's got hams hid someplace, smoked and salted hams, and bacon too.
Sausage, said Dirk. Them long black ones, they're like rocks they keep for years. I'll bet he's got 100 hanging in some cellar.
Oats, suggested Ollo Lophen. Corn, barley.
Corn,
said Mormont's raven, with a flap of its wings.
Corn, 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 corn.
Enough, said Lord Commander Mormont over the bird's raucous calls.
Be quiet, all of you. This is folly.
Apples, said Garth of Greenaway. Barrels and barrels of crisp autumn apples. There are apple trees out there. I saw them.
Dried berries, cabbages, pine nuts.
Corn, corn, corn.
Salt mutton. There's a sheepfold. He's got casks and casks of mutton laid by. You know he does.
Craster looked fit to spit them all by then. Lord Commander Mormont rose.
Silence! I'll hear no more such talk.
Then stuff bread in your ears, old man,
Clubfoot Carl pushed back from the table.
Or did you swallow your bloody crumb already?
Sam saw the old bear's face grow red.
Have you forgotten who I am? Sit, eat, and be silent. That is a command.
No one spoke. No one moved. All eyes were on the Lord Commander and the big club-footed ranger as the two of them stared at each other across the table. It seemed to Sam that Carl broke first and was about to sit, though sullenly. But Craster stood, and his axe was in his hand, the big black steel axe that Mormont had given him as a guest gift.
No, he growled, you're not sick. No one who calls me niggard will sleep under my roof, nor eat at my board. Out with you, cripple! And you, and you, and you!
He jabbed the head of the axe toward Dirk and Garth in turn.
Or go sleep in a cold, with empty bellies, the lot of you, or...
Bloody bastard!
Sam heard one of the Garths curse. He never saw which one.
Or who calls me bastard?
Craster roared, sweeping platter and meat and wine cups from the table with his left hand while lifting the axe with his right.
It's no more than all men know,
Carl answered. Craster moved quicker than Sam would have believed possible, vaulting across the table with axe in hand. A woman screamed. Garth Greenaway and Orphan Us drew knives. Carl stumbled back and tripped over Sir Byam, lying wounded on the floor. One instant, Craster was coming after him, spitting curses. The next, he was spitting blood. Dirk had grabbed him by the hair, yanked his head back, and opened his throat, ear to ear, with one long slash. Then he gave him a rough shove, and the wildling fell forward, crashing face first across a Byam. Byam screamed in agony as Craster drowned in his own blood, the axe slipping from his fingers. Two of Craster's wives were wailing. A third cursed, a fourth flew at sweet Donal and tried to scratch his eyes out. He knocked her to the floor. The Lord Commander stood over Craster's corpse, dark with anger.
The gods will curse us, he cried. There is no crime so foul as for a guest to bring murder into a man's hall. By all the laws of the hearth, we...
There are no laws beyond the wall, O man, remember? Dirk grabbed one of Craster's wives by the arm and shoved the point of his bloody dirk up under her chin.
Show us where he keeps the food, or you'll get the same as he did, woman.
On hander, Mormont took a step. I'll have your head for this, you...
Garth of Greenaway blocked his path and Ola Lophan yanked him back. They both had blades in hand. "Hold your tongue," Olo warned. Instead, the Lord Commander grabbed for his dagger. Olo had only one hand, but that was quick. He twisted free of the old man's grasp, shoved the knife into Mormont's belly, and yanked it out again, all red. And then the world went mad. Later, much later, Sam found himself sitting cross-legged on the floor with Mormont's head in his lap. He did not remember how they'd gotten there, or much of anything else that had happened after the old bear was stabbed. Garth of Greenaway had killed Garth of Oldtown, he recalled, but not why. Rowley of Sisterton had fallen from the loft and broken his neck after climbing the ladder to have a taste of Craster's wives. Gren had shouted and slapped him, and then run away with Giant and Dolorous Ed and some others. Craster still sprawled across the biome, but the wounded knight no longer moaned. Four men in black sat on the bench eating chunks of burned horse meat, while Olo coupled with a weeping woman on the table.
"Charlie."
When he tried to speak, the blood dribbled from the old bear's mouth down into his beard.
"Charlie, go! Go!"
"Where, my lord?" His voice was flat and lifeless.
"I'm not afraid." It was a queer feeling. "There's no place to go."
"The wall. Make for the wall. Now."
"Now,"
squawked the raven.
"Now. Now."
The bird walked up the old man's arm to his chest and plucked a hair from his beard.
"You must tell them."
"Tell them what, my lord?" Sam asked politely.
"All. The fist, the wildlings, dragonglass, this, all."
His breathing was very shallow now, his voice a whisper.
"Tell my son, Jorah. Tell him, take the black. My wish. Dying wish."
"Wish?"
The raven cocked his head, beady black eyes shining.
"Corn?"
the bird asked.
"No corn," said Mormont feebly. "Tell Jorah. Forgive him, my son. Please. Go."
"It's too far," said Sam. "I'll never reach the wall, my lord."
He was so very tired. All he wanted was to sleep. To sleep and sleep and never wake. And he knew that if he had just stayed here, soon enough Dirk or Olo Lophan or Clubfoot Carl would get angry with him and grant his wish, just to see him die.
"I'd sooner stay with you. See, I'm not frightened any more of you or of anything."
"You should be,"
said a woman's voice. Three of Craster's wives were standing over them. Two were haggard old women he did not know, but Gilly was between them, all bundled up in skins and cradling a bundle of brown and white fur that must have been her baby.
"We're not supposed to talk to Craster's wives," Sam told them. "We have orders."
"That's done now," said the old woman on the right.
"The blackest crows are down in the cellar gorging," said the old woman on the left, "or up in the loft with the young ones. They'll be back soon, though. Best you be gone when they do. The horses run off, but Dyer's caught too."
"You said you'd help me,"
Gilly reminded him.
"I said John would help you. John's brave and he's a good fighter, but I think he's dead now. I'm a craven and fat. Look how fat I am. Besides, Lord Mormont's hurt. Can't you see? I couldn't leave the Lord Commander."
"Child," said the other old woman, "that old crow's gone before you. Look."
Mormont's head was still in his lap, but his eyes were open and staring, and his lips no longer moved. The raven cocked its head and squawked, then looked up at Sam.
"Corn?"
"No corn. He has no corn."
Sam closed the old bear's eyes and tried to think of a prayer, but all that came to mind was,
"Mother have mercy, Mother have mercy, Mother have mercy."
"Your mother can't help you none,"
said the old woman on the left.
"That dead old man can't neither. You take his sword, and you take that big warm fur cloak of his, and you take his horse, if you can find him, and you go."
"The girl don't lie," the old woman on the right said. "She's my girl, and I beat the lying out of her early on. You said you'd help her. Do what Fernie says, boy. Take the girl and be quick about it."
"Quick,"
the raven said.
"Quick, quick, quick."
"Where?" asked Sam, puzzled. "Where should I take her?"
"Someplace warm,"
the two old women said as one. Gilly was crying.
"Me and the babe, please. I'll be your wife, like I was Craster's. Please, Sir Crow, he's a boy, just like Nella said he'd be. If you don't take him, they will."
"They?" said Sam, and the raven cocked its black head and echoed,
They. "The boy's brothers," said the old woman on the left, "Craster's sons. The white coal's rising out there, Crow. I can feel it in my bones. These poor old bones don't lie. They'll be here soon. The sons."
Tirion. The Selasauri Corran was 7 days from Volantis when Penny finally emerged from her cabin, creeping up on deck like some timid woodland creature emerging from a long winter sleep. It was dusk, and the Red Priest had lit his night fire in the great iron brazier amidships, as the crew gathered around to pray. Makaro's voice was a bass drum that seemed to boom from somewhere deep within his massive torso.
"We thank you for your son that keeps us warm," he prayed. "We thank you for your stars that watch over us as we sail this coal-black sea."
A huge man, taller than Sir Jorah, and wide enough to make two of him. The priest wore scarlet robes, embroidered at sleeve and hem and collar, with orange satin flames. His skin was black as pitch, his hair as white as snow. The flames tattooed across his cheeks and brow, yellow and orange. His iron staff was as tall as he was, and crowned with a dragon's head. When he stamped its butt upon the deck, the dragon's maw spat crackling green flame. His guardsmen, 5 slave warriors of the Fiery Hand, led the responses. They chanted in the tongue of old Volantis, but Tirion had heard the prayers enough to grasp the essence. "Light our fire and protect us from the dark, blah, blah. Light our way and keep us toasty warm. The night is dark and full of terrors. Save us from the scary things and blah, blah, blah," some more. He knew better than to voice such thoughts aloud. Tirion Lannister had no use for any god, but on this ship it was wise to show a certain respect for Red Relor. Jorah Mormont had removed Tyrion's chains and fetters once they were safely underway, and the dwarf did not wish to give him cause to clap them on again. The Selasauri Corran was a wallowing tub of 500 tons, with a deep hold, high castles fore and aft, and a single mast between. At her forecastle stood a grotesque figurehead, some worm-eaten wooden eminence with a constipated look and a scroll tucked up under one arm. Tirion had never seen an uglier ship. Her crew was no prettier. Her captain, a mean-mouthed, flinty, kettle-bellied man, with close-set, greedy eyes, was a bad Syvess player and a worse loser. Under him served 4 mates, freedmen all, and 50 slaves bound to the ship, each with a crude version of the cog's figurehead tattooed upon one cheek. "No nose," the sailors liked to call Tirion, no matter how many times he told them his name was Hugo Hill. 3 of the mates and more than 3/4 of the crew were fervent worshippers of the Lord of Light. Tirion was less certain about the captain, who always emerged for the evening prayers but took no other part in them. But Makoro was the true master of the Selasori Koran, at least for this voyage.
Lord of Light, bless your slave Makoro, and light his way in the dark places of the world,
the Red Priest boomed,
and defend your righteous slave, Banero. Grant him courage, grant him wisdom, fill his heart with fire.
That was when Tyrion noticed Penny, watching the mummery from the steep wooden stair that led down beneath the stone castle. She stood on one of the lower steps, so only the top of her head was visible. Beneath her hood, her eyes shone big and white in the light of the night fire. She had a dog with her, the big grey hound she rode in the muck joss.
"My lady,"
Tyrion called softly. In truth, she was no lady, but he could not bring himself to mouth that silly name of hers, and he was not about to call her girl or dwarf. She cringed back.
I did not see you.
Well, I am small.
I was unwell.
Her dog barked. Sick with grief, you mean?
If I can be of help, no.
And quick as that, she was gone again, retreating back below to the cabin that she shared with her dog and sow. Tyrion could not fault her. The crew of the Selasori Koran had been pleased enough when he first came on board. A dwarf was good luck, after all. His head had been rubbed so often and so vigorously that it was a wonder that he wasn't bald. But Penny had met with a more mixed reaction. She might be a dwarf, but she was also a woman, and women were bad luck aboard ship. For every man who tried to rub her head, there were three who muttered maledictions under their breath when she went by. "And the sight of me can only be salt in her wound. They hacked off her brother's head in the hope that it was mine. Yet here I sit, like some bloody gargoyle, offering empty consolations. If I were her, I'd want nothing more than to shove me into the sea." He felt nothing but pity for the girl. She did not deserve the horror visited on her in Volantis any more than her brother had. The last time he had seen her, just before they left port, her eyes had been raw from crying, two ghastly red holes in a wan pale face. By the time they raised sail, she had locked herself in her cabin with her dog and her pig, but at night they could hear her weeping. Only yesterday he had heard one of the mates say that they ought to throw her overboard before her tears could swamp the ship. Tyrion was not entirely sure he had been japing. When the evening prayers had ended, and the ship's crew had once again dispersed, some to their watch and others to food and rum and hammocks, Makoro remained beside his night fire, as he did every night. The Red Priest rested by day, but kept vigil through the dark hours, to tend his sacred flames so that the sun might return to them at dawn. Tyrion squatted across from him and warmed his hands against the night's chill. Makoro took no notice of him for several moments. He was staring into the flickering flames, lost in some vision. "Does he see days yet to come, as he claims?" If so, that was a fearsome gift. After a time, the priest raised his eyes to meet the dwarf's.
"Hugo Hill," he said, inclining his head in a solemn nod. "Have you come to pray with me?"
"Someone told me that the night is dark and full of terrors. What do you see in those flames?"
"Dragons," Makoro said, in the common tongue of Westeros.
He spoke it very well, with hardly a trace of accent. No doubt that was one reason that the High Priest, Banero, had chosen him to bring the faith for a law to Daenerys Targaryen.
"Dragons old and young, true and false, bright and dark, and you, a small man with a big shadow, snarling in the midst of all.
Snarling? An amiable fellow like me?
Tyrion was almost flattered. And no doubt that is just what he intends. Every fool loves to hear that he's important.
Perhaps it was Penny you saw. We're almost of a size.
No, my friend.
My friend? When did that happen, I wonder? Did you see how long it will take us to reach Meereen?
You are eager to behold the world's deliverer.
Yes and no. The world's deliverer may snick off my head or give me to our dragons as a savory. Not me, said Tyrion. For me, it is all about the olives, though I fear I may grow old and die before I taste one. I could dog-paddle faster than we're sailing. Tell me, was Selis or Coran a triarch or a turtle?
The Red Priest chuckled.
Neither. Coran is not a ruler, but one who serves and counsels such, and helps conduct his business. You of Westeros might say Stuart or Magister.
King's Hand. That amused him. And Selisori?
Makoro touched his nose.
Imbued with a pleasant aroma. Fragrant, would you say? Flowery.
So Selisori, Coran, means stinky Stuart, more or less.
A fragrant Stuart, rather.
Tyrion gave a crooked grin.
I believe I will stay with Stinky, but I do thank you for the lesson.
I am pleased to have enlightened you. Perhaps some day you will let me teach you the truth of R'hllor as well.
Someday, when I'm ahead on a spike.
The quarters he shared with Ser Jorah were a cabin only by courtesy. The dank, dark, foul-smelling closet had barely enough space to hang a pair of sleeping hammocks, one above the other. He found Mormont stretched out in the lower one, swaying slowly with the motion of the ship.
The girl finally poked her nose above decks, Tyrion told him. One look at me and she scurried right back down below.
You're not a pretty sight.
Not all of us can be as comely as you. The girl is lost. It would not surprise me if the poor creature wasn't sneaking up to jump over the side and drown herself.
The poor creature's name is Penny.
I know her name.
He hated her name. Her brother had gone by the name of Groat, though his true name had been Uppo.
Groat and Penny, the smallest coins worth the least. And what's worse, they chose the names themselves.
It left a bad taste in Tyrion's mouth.
By any name, she needs a friend.
Ser Jorah sat up in his hammock.
Befriend her, then. Marry her, for all I care.
That left a bad taste in his mouth as well.
Like with like. Is that your notion? Or do you mean to find a she-bear for yourself, sir?
You were the one who insisted that we bring her.
I said we could not abandon her in Volantis. That does not mean I want to fuck her. She wants me dead. Have you forgotten? I'm the last person she's like to want as a friend.
You're both dwarfs?
Yes, and so was her brother, who was killed because some drunken fools took him for me.
Feeling guilty, are you?
No, Tyrion bristled. I have sins enough to answer for. I'll have no part of this one. I might have nurtured some ill will toward her and her brother for the part they played the night of Joffrey's wedding, but I never wish them harm.
You are a harmless creature, to be sure. Innocent as a lamb.
Ser Jorah got to his feet.
The dwarf girl is your burden. Kiss her, kill her, or avoid her, as you like. It's naught to me.
He shouldered past Tyrion and out of the cabin.
Twice exiled, and small wonder, Tyrion thought. I'd exile him too if I could. The man is cold, brooding, sullen,
deaf to humour. And those are his good points. Sir Jorah spent most of his waking hours pacing the forecastle, or leaning on the rail, gazing out to sea. Looking for his Silver Queen, looking for Daenerys, willing the ship to sail faster. Well, I might do the same if Tysha waited in Meereen. Could Slaver's Bay be where Hawes went? It seemed unlikely. From what he'd read, the slaver cities were the place where Hawes were made. Mormont should have brought one for himself. A pretty slave girl might have done wonders to improve his temper, particularly one with silvery hair, like the whore who'd been sitting on his cock back in Silhoris. On the river, Tyrion had to endure Griff, but there had at least been the mystery of the captain's true identity to divert him, and the more congenial companionship of the rest of the pole boat's little company. On the cog, alas, everyone was just who they appeared to be. No one was particularly congenial, and only the Red Priest was interesting. Him and maybe Penny, but the girl hates me, and she should. Life aboard the Selous Orichorin was nothing if not tedious, Tyrion had found. The most exciting part of his day was pricking his toes and fingers with a knife. On the river there had been wonders to behold, giant turtles, ruined cities, stone men, naked scepters. One never knew what might be lurking around the next bend. The days and nights at sea were all the same. Leaving Volantis, the cog had sailed within sight of land at first, so Tyrion could gaze at passing headlands, watch clouds of seabirds rise from stony cliffs and crumbling watchtowers, count bare brown islands as they slipped past. He saw many other ships as well, fishing boats, lumbering merchantmen, proud galleys with their oars lashing the waves into white foam. But once they struck out into deeper waters, there was only sea and sky, air and water. The water looked like water. The sky looked like sky. Sometimes there was a cloud. Too much blue. And the nights were worse. Tyrion slept badly at the best of times, and this was far from that. Sleep meant dreams, as like as not, and in his dreams the sorrows waited. And a stony king with his father's face. That left him with a beggar's choice of climbing up into his hammock and listening to Jorah Mormont snore beneath him, or remaining above decks to contemplate the sea. On moonless nights, the water was as black as maester's ink, from horizon to horizon, dark and deep and forbidding, beautiful in a chilly sort of way. But when he looked at it too long, Tyrion found himself musing on how easy it would be to slip over the gunwale and drop down into that darkness. One very small splash, and the pathetic little tale that was his life would soon be done. But what if there is a hell, and my father is waiting for me? The best part of each evening was supper. The food was not especially good, but it was plentiful, so that was where the dwarf went next. The galley where he took his meals was a cramped and uncomfortable space, with a ceiling so low that the taller passengers were always in danger of cracking their heads, a hazard the strapping slave soldiers of the Fiery Hand seemed particularly prone to. As much as Tyrion enjoyed sniggering at that, he had come to prefer taking his meals alone. Sitting at a crowded table with men who did not share a common language with you, listening to them talk and jape whilst understanding none of it, had quickly grown wearisome. Particularly since he always found himself wondering if the japes and laughter were directed at him. The galley was also where the ship's books were kept. Her captain being an especially bookish man, she carried three. A collection of nautical poetry that went from bad to worse, a well-thumbed tome about the erotic adventures of a young slave girl in a Lycian pillow house, and the fourth and